She suddenly looked very tired.
Your killer was but the proxy of another being, and one mightier and more dangerous than he.
He? Male? The pool dwindled by half, give or take.
So aside from the dick who killed me, I also had his boss to worry about.
Super.
I can say no more, godson, Leah said.
You have already said too much.
Leah lifted her hand as if to shield her face from a sudden wind and scowled at Eternal Silence's direction.
Your knowledge of mortals is relatively scarce. It is done. Desist your howling.
Leah paused to look to one side again, stiffened her back a little, and added a belated and unenthusiastic,
If you please.
The silent figure looked from my godmother to me, and though it didn't have lungs with which to draw breath, I somehow sensed that it was about to speak.
I know, I said hurriedly. I know. Know my path. No need to blow my brains out repeating yourself.
Eternal Silence seemed faintly, vaguely annoyed. There came a purely psychic sensation, something that really reminded me of an unsatisfied grunt. Then the statue turned away and vanished from my sight. Huh, I said, after the figure had gone. What the hell was that about?
Proxies, the Linanshi muttered, barely audible. Always proxies. And respect.
What? She gave me a direct look, and I had the impression that she was saying something with particular meaning.
Proxies, child. Those who appear to speak on behalf of another who cannot be present. Much as I have served as a proxy for my queen over the years, or she for me.
Leah shook her head and said,
I must go, child.
Wait, I said, reaching up to touch her foot with my hand. My ectoplasmic flesh did not sink through hers. My hand felt nothing, yet met an odd resistance to its motion. I didn't pass into her as I had Mort or Molly. I blinked a little at that.
I am of two worlds, she said, her tone slightly impatient. As she often did, she had evidently guessed at my thoughts. Of course, I don't feel the same as mortal flesh.
Oh, I said.
Listen. I need to know that you're going to take care of Molly.
She tilted her head and studied me for a moment.
But, child, it was never your responsibility to care for the young woman.
Yes, it was, I said. She was my apprentice.
Indeed. Someone whom you had pledged to teach, not to care for. Child, did you miss the entire point of the exercise?
I opened my mouth and then closed it again. Maybe I did. What was supposed to happen?
You were supposed to teach her to care for herself, Leah replied in a matter-of-fact tone. Your failure to do so, she frowned. I confess that I have only a limited understanding of the concepts of good and evil. The differences seem largely semantic to me when applied to empiric situations. Yet it seems to me that you did her no great kindness by being gentle.
I met the she's impassive gaze for a moment before I looked away. You might be right.
I am very old, child. It is a safe assumption in most circumstances.
She sniffed and leaned down to pat my hand in a rather peremptory gesture.
Now then, listen to the nice statue, and do try to destroy anyone who seeks to do you harm. Death should be a learning experience, after all, or what's the point?
Something in my godmother's words managed to land on the ghost of a functioning brain cell somewhere, and a flash of inspiration hit me.
That's it, I blurted. That's how to handle the corpse taker.
Leah tilted her head, her eyes intent, and then smiled a knowing smile.
If you can do it, I swallowed.
Yeah.
Interesting, she murmured.
If you can control them. They are a power potentially deadly, even to the one who wields it.
Explosive, dangerous, and very typical of you. Excellent.
Then she moved the fingers of her right hand through a series of little gestures and was gone. That left me alone in my grave with my thoughts.
I leaned against the wall again, but I didn't settle down on the ground. Instead, I thought about Molly and how screwed up she was. That was my fault in a lot of ways. First thing to jump out of me, I should never have let Molly go to Chichen Itza. I had led her into the fight of my life against the Red Court to save my daughter. But I shouldn't have exposed Molly to that. She was a sensitive, a wizard whose magical senses were naturally attuned to the finest, lightest, most delicate workings of the art. Or to put it in more hairy-friendly terms, she had great big honking Dumbo ears that were extremely sensitive to loud noises. Magic is life. Some forms of death, like murder, the abrupt and violent termination of a life that was not otherwise ending, were the equivalent of enormous screeching feedback to her senses. And I had dragged her into a freaking concert hall of it at Chichen Itza. Murder-palooza. Not to mention setting off the biggest, most violent magical curse to be unleashed in the past century. Hell, I wasn't exactly a sensitive guy, magically speaking. But even I had a blank spot in my memory over the minutes right after that arcane explosion. It's gotta be bad for me to shut it out. For Molly, it had to have been a whole lot worse. And, oh yes, she had been shot and nearly killed to go with everything else. I had watched her collapse from blood loss. Mistake. It had been a big damn mistake. At the time, I'd been so focused on getting Maggie out that I'd let Molly persuade me that she deserved to be on the team. I never would have let her do that if I'd been thinking straight. I would have told her to stay at home, hold the fort, or maybe stay in the car. That was what I'd always done when I was on my way to a slugfest. Exposure to that kind of noise could quite effectively shatter her sanity. And maybe it had. Even if her mental house was still on a good foundation, you didn't need monsters or magic to get damaged by a brush with death. Soldiers coming home from wars had known that for centuries. Post-traumatic stress disorder from life-threatening injuries had screwed up the lives of a lot of people. People who didn't have supernatural powers as a possible outlet for their anger, fear, grief, or guilt. And who had been there to catch her? The freaking Linanshi, deputy of her wickedness, with her Nietzsche and Darwin were sentimental pansies outlook on life. Stars and stones. When Molly insisted on going, why didn't I just tell her, "Of course you can come, Grasshopper. I've always wanted to create a mentally mutilated monster of my very own." Man, it wasn't the legacy I'd wanted to leave behind me. I mean, I had never thought much about leaving a legacy, truth be told. But an apprentice with a crippled heart and mind, who was probably going to get hunted down by her own people, was definitely never in the plan. "Oh, kid," I breathed to no one. "Molly, I'm so sorry." It turns out ghosts can cry. "Over here," said a familiar voice. It was later, but not much later. Sometime afternoon, maybe. It was hard to tell from the grave.
"You've never even been here before," answered another. "I was at the funeral. How the hell would you know where his grave was?"
I heard Fitz let out a sigh, front-loaded with so much drama that only a teenager could have managed it without hurting himself.
"Is it the gaping hole in the ground over there with a big pentacle on the headstone?"
There was a brief, miffed pause, and Butters answered,
"Okay, maybe it is."
Footsteps crunched through wet, melting snow. Fitz and Butters appeared at the edge of my grave and peered down.
"Well," Butters asked, "is he there?"
"How the hell should I know?" Fitz replied. "I don't see dead people, I hear them, and I don't hear anything."
"Hey, Fitz," I said. The kid jumped. He was wearing his newly laundered clothes and had added one of Fort Hill's old coats over the top of everything.
"Christ, yeah, he's there."
"Oh, fantastic," Butters said.
"Hi, Harry. Here, man, help me down."
"Help you down? It's like 5 feet to the bottom, if that. Just jump down."
Jump into an open grave? What kind of idiot are you? Butters replied. I might as well put on a red shirt and volunteer for the away team. There's snow and ice and slippery mud down there. That's like asking for an ironically broken neck.
Are all doctors whiny girls like you? Fitz asked.
Hey, this whiny girl is still alive because he doesn't do stupid crap.
Fitz snorted.
So I help you down, my foot slips, we both fall in and die.
Butters lifted an eyebrow and grunted.
Huh, true.
I pinched at the bridge of my nose.
Oh, hell's bells, guys. Either get a room or stop flirting and get down here.
Ha ha, Fitz said toward me crossly. He just called us gay. Butters blinked.
For not jumping into a hole we might not be able to climb out of? That's kind of insensitive.
Not for that, for... Fitz let out a sigh of vintage teenage impatience.
Christ, just give me your hand, okay? I'll swing you down.
Butters fussed for a moment more, making sure that Fitz had a solid place to plant his feet, and then he swung down into my grave. He was wearing his winter gear again and carrying the gym bag. Once he was down, he made sure he was out of direct sunlight and started opening the bag.
What's up? I asked Fitz.
Trouble, Fitz said.
We need your help, Harry, Butters said.
Hey, wait, I said, scowling. How did Butters find you, Fitz?
He asked, Fitz said to Butters.
The little M.E. nodded.
Harry, I got from Murphy that you were apparently going into social work. It wasn't hard to figure out who you'd ask for help. So I went over to the church to talk to Fort Hill about the situation, except he wasn't there.
Fitz bit his lip.
Look, Dresden, the father and I talked, and he decided he was going to talk to Aristides on my behalf.
I blinked and pushed away from the grave wall.
What?
I tried to tell him, Fitz said. He wouldn't listen.
I think he was angry. But he said he was going to resolve this before it came to some kind of bloodshed.
Hell's bells. I'd known Aristides' type in the past. If it suited him, he'd kill Fort Hill without an instant's hesitation. The good father was in danger.
Murphy would go in with guns blazing, Butters said. She's going to break my arm when she finds out I didn't tell her. We need you to help talk us through this.
That's crazy, I said. Go in guns blazing.
It's too late for that, Fitz said. Look, Fort Hill is already there. I just met the guy, but I don't want him to get hurt for me. We have to move now.
I can't, I said. I can't move around in broad daylight.
We thought of that, Fitz said. Butters said you needed a shielded vessel.
Butters said that, did he? I asked wryly.
Butters rose from the bag, holding a plastic flashlight case holding Bob's skull. He winked at me, held it out, and said,
"Hop in."
I blinked. Then I said, "Right, let's go." I took a deep breath and willed myself forward into the staring eye sockets of the skull. Chapter 35. There was a very, very odd, swirling sensation as my spirit self leapt forward, and then I was standing in an apartment. Okay, when I say apartment, I don't mean it like my old place. I lived in a mostly buried box that was maybe 20 by 30 total, not including the sub-basement where my lab had been. Apartment Dresden had been full of paperback books on scarred wooden shelves and comfortable second-hand furniture. This was more like apartment Bond, James apartment Bond, penthouse Bond, really. There was a lot of black marble and mahogany. There was a fireplace the size of a carport, complete with a modest, relatively modest, blaze going in it. The furniture all matched. The rich hardwoods from which it had been made were hand-carved in intricate designs. It wasn't until the second glance that I saw some of the same rune and sigil work I'd used on my own staff and blasting rod. The cushions on the couches, plural, couches, and recliners and sedans and chaises, plural, chaises, were made of rich fabric I couldn't identify, maybe some kind of raw silk, and embroidered with more of the same symbols in gold and silver thread. A nearby table boasted what looked like a freshly roasted turkey,
along with a spread of fruits and vegetables and side dishes of every kind. It was sort of ridiculous, really. There was enough food there to feed a small nation, but there weren't any plates to fill up, and there weren't any utensils to eat it with. It looked gorgeous, and it smelled incredible, but there was something inert about it, something lifeless. There was no nourishment on that table, not for the body or for the spirit. One wall was covered in a curtain. I started to pull it aside and found it responding to the touch, spreading open of its own accord to reveal a television the size of a billboard, a high-tech stereo system, and an entire shelf lined with one kind of video game console after another, complicated little controls sitting neatly next to each one. I can't tell a Playbox from an X station, but who can keep track of all of them? There are like 1,000 different kinds of machines to play video games on. I mean, honestly. I said, "Hello?" My voice echoed quite distinctly, more than it should have, huge marble cavern or not. "Anybody home?" There was, I kid you not, a drum roll. Then, from a curtained archway, there appeared a young man. He looked quite ordinary, really. Tall, but not outrageously so, slender without being rail-thin. He had decent shoulders and looked sort of familiar. He was dressed like James Dean, jeans, a white shirt, a leather biker's jacket. The outfit looked a little odd on him, somehow forced, except for a little skull embroidered in white thread on the jacket, just over the young man's heart. Cymbals crashed, and he spread his arms. "Ta-da!" "Bob," I said. I felt one side of my mouth curling up in amusement. "This? This is the place you always wanted me to let you out of? You could fit 5 or 6 of mine in here." His face spread into a wide grin.
"Well, I admit my crib is pretty sweet, but a gold cage is still a cage, Harry."
"A gold fallout shelter, more like."
"Either way, you get stir-crazy every few decades," he said, and flopped down onto a chaise. "You get that this isn't literally what the inside of the skull is like, right?"
"It's my head interpreting what I see into familiar things, yeah," I said. "It's getting to be kind of common."
"Welcome to the world of spirit," Bob said.
"What's with the food?"
"Butters's mom is kind of a food goddess," Bob said, his eyes widening.
"That's the spread she's put out over the last few holidays. Or, Butters's sensory memories of it, anyway. He let me do a ride-along, and then I made this facsimile of what we experienced."
I lifted my eyebrows. "He let you do a ride-along? In his head?" Bob was not well known for his restraint, in my experience, when he got to go on one of his excursions.
"There was a contract first," Bob said. "A limiting document, about 20 pages long. He covered his bases."
"Huh," I said. I nodded at the food. "And you just remade it?"
"Oh, sure," Bob said. "I can remake whatever in here." He waggled his eyebrows. "You want to see a replay of that time Molly got the acid all over her clothes in the lab and had to strip?"
Pass," I said. I sat down gingerly on a chair, making sure I wasn't going to sink through it or something. It seemed to behave like a normal chair. "TV and stuff, too?"
"I am kind of made out of energy, man," Bob said. He pointed at the wall of media equipment. "You remember me broadcasting to your spirit radio, right? I'm, like, totally tapped in now. Television, satellite imagery, broadband internet, you name it, I can do it. How do you think I know so much?"
"Hundreds of years of assisting wizards," I said. He waved a hand.
"That too, but I got this whole huge internet thing to play on now. Butters showed me."
His grin turned into a leer.
"And it's like 90% porn."
"There's the Bob I know and love," I said.
"Thav, ick," he replied. "And I am, and I'm not. I mean, you get that I change based on who possesses the skull, right?"
"Sure," I said.
"So I'm a lot like I was with you, even though I'm with Butters, because he met me back then, first impressions and whatnot, highly important."
I grunted. "How long do we have to talk?"
Not as simple to answer as you think, Bob said. But you're still pretty cherry, so let's keep it simple. A few minutes, speaking linearly. But I can stretch it out for a while, subjectively.
Huh, I said. Neat.
Nah, just sort of the way we roll on this side of the street, he said. What do you want to know?
Who killed me, I replied.
Oh, sorry. Can't help you with that, except as a sounding board.
Okay, I said. Let me catch you up on what I know. I filled Bob in on everything since the train tunnel. I didn't hold back much of anything. Bob was smart enough to fill in the vast majority of gaps if I left anything out anyway. And he could compile information and deduce coherent facts as well as any mind I'd ever known. And besides, he was my oldest friend. He listened, his gold-brown eyes intent, completely focused on me.
Wow, he said when I'd finished. You are so completely fucked.
I arched an eyebrow at him and said, How do you figure? He rolled his eyes.
Oh, where do I start? How about with the obvious? Uriel.
Uriel? I said. What?
A wizard tied in with a bunch of really elemental sources of power dies right after signing off on some deals that guarantee he's about to become a whole hell of a lot darker, capital letter intended, and there's this sudden, he made air quotes with his fingers, irregularity about his death. He gets sent back to the mortal coil to get involved again. And you think an angel isn't involved somewhere? Remember, Uriel is the black ops guy of the archangels. He's conned the father of lies, for crying out loud. You think he wouldn't scam you?
I said. I felt a little thick.
See, Bob said. Your first tidy piece of flesh-free existence, and already you're lost without me.
I shook my head. Look, man, I'm just a spirit now. This is just like paperwork I'm getting filled out before I catch the train to wherever. Bob rolled his eyes again and snorted.
Oh, sure it is. You get sent back here just as the freaking corpse taker is setting herself up as Queen of Chicago, getting ready to wipe out the defenders of humanity, such as they are, here in town. And it's just a coincidence, business as usual. He sniffed. They're totally playing you.
They? I said.
Think about it, Bob said. I mean, stop for a minute and actually think. I know it's been a while.
Winter, I said. Snow a foot deep at the end of spring. Queen Mab.
Obviously, Bob said. She's here, in Chicago, somewhere. And because, duh, she's Winter Queen, she brought winter with her.
He pursed his lips.
For a few more days, anyway.
Bob was right. Mab might flaunt her power in the face of the oncoming season, but if she didn't back down, her opposite number, Titania, would come for her, at the height of summer's power, the solstice, if previous patterns held true.
Harry, I don't want to comment about your new girlfriend, but she's still here 6 months after you got shot. Seems kind of clingy.
Wait, I said. You are saying that Mab and Uriel are in on something, together. The Queen of Air and Darkness and a flipping archangel.
We live in strange times, Bob said philosophically. They're peers of a sort, Harry. Hey, word is that even the Almighty and Lucifer worked a deal on Job. Spider-Man has teamed up with the Sandman before. Luke and Vader did the Emperor. It happens.
Spider-Man is pretend and doesn't count, I said.
You start drawing distinctions like this now? Bob asked. Besides, he's real, like somewhere.
I blinked.
What?
You think your universe is the only universe?
Come on, Harry. Creation, totally freaking huge. Room enough for you and Spider-Man both.
He spread his hands.
Look, I'm not a faith guy. I don't know what happens on the other side. Or if you wind up going to a heaven or hell or something reasonably close to them. That isn't my bag. But I know a shell game when I see one.
I swallowed and pushed a hand back through my hair. The Fomor servitors, Corpse Taker and her gang, even Aristides and his little crew, they're pieces on the board.
Just like you, Bob agreed cheerfully.
Notice anyone else who pushed you a space or two recently? By which I mean that you only recently noticed.
I scowled. Other than everyone around me?
I was sort of thinking about the one behind you, Bob said. His expression grew suddenly serious. The walker.
I took a slow breath. He who walks behind. It was only now, looking back at my crystalline memories and applying what I'd learned during my adult lifetime since they happened, that I could really appreciate what had gone on that night. The walker had never been trying to kill me. If it had wanted to do that, it didn't need to play with me. It could simply have appeared and executed me the way it had poor Stan at the gas station. It had been trying to push me, to shape me into something dangerous, like maybe a weapon. Like maybe the same way Justin had. I had always assumed that Justin had controlled He Who Walks Behind, that my old master had sent him after me when I fled. But what if I'd been a flipping idiot? What if their relationship had worked the other way around? What if Justin, who had betrayed me, had similarly been backstabbed by his own inhuman mentor, when the creature had, in essence, prepared me to destroy Justin? "Lot of really scary symmetry there," I whispered.
"Yeah," Bob said, still serious. "You are in a scary place, Harry." He took a deep breath. "And it gets worse."
"Worse?
How?" "It's just a theory," he said, "because this isn't my bag. But look, there's flesh and there's spirit, right?"
"Yeah," I said.
"Mortals have both, right there together, along with the soul."
"I thought it was the same thing, soul, spirit."
Bob said, "complicated. Think of your spirit self as a seed. Your soul is the earth it grows in. You need both when you die. The way I've heard it, they sort of blend together to become something new. It's a caterpillar butterfly thing."
"Okay," I said. "How does that make it worse?"
"You, here, now, aren't a spirit," Bob said. "You aren't a real ghost. You're just running around in your freaking soul, man. I mean, for practical purposes, it's the same thing, but..."
"But what?"
"But if something happens to you here, now, it's for keeps. I mean, forever. You could capital E end, man. Spin right off the wheel altogether, or worse."
I swallowed. I mean, I realized that I'd been in a serious situation all the way down the line, but not one that could potentially be described using words like eternal. "Joy." Bob shook his head.
"I didn't think it was possible for them to do that to you. According to what I've heard, your soul's your own. I'd have thought you would have to walk into something like this willingly, but..."
I held up the heel of my hand and butted my forehead against it in steady rhythm.
"Oh, Harry," Bob said, his voice profoundly disappointed. "You didn't." "They didn't explain it exactly the way you did," I said, "not in so many words." "But they gave you a choice."
Captain Murphy had done exactly that. It had been phrased in such a way that I hadn't really had much of a choice, but I'd had a choice. "Yeah."
"And you chose to hazard your eternal soul? Even though you get all worked up about that sort of thing." "It wasn't phrased quite like that," I began.
Only it really had been. Jack had warned me that I might be trapped forever, hadn't he? Or, well, yeah, I guess technically I did.
"Well," Bob said. He cleared his throat. "You idiot."
"Oh," I said. "My head hurts."
"No, it doesn't," Bob said scornfully. "You just think it should."
I paused and reflected and saw that Bob was right. And I decided that my head hurt anyway, damn it. Just because I was a spirit or a naked soul or whatever didn't mean I needed to start ignoring who I had been.
"Bob," I said, lifting my head suddenly, "what does this mean? I mean, why not just let me die and move along like normal?"
Bob pursed his lips.
Yeah. No clue."
"What if..." I felt short of breath. I hardly wanted to say it.
What if I'm not? Bob's eyes widened.
Oh. Oh! Uriel's people! Murphy's dad and so on! Did they say anything about your body?
That it wasn't available, I said.
But not that it was gone,
Bob pressed. No, I said. They didn't say that.
Wow, Bob said, eyes wide.
Mine probably were, too. What do I do?
How the hell should I know, man? Bob asked. I've never had a soul or a body. What did they tell you to do?
Find my killer, I said. But that means I'm dead, right? Bob waved a hand.
Harry, dead isn't... Look, even by terms of the non-supernatural, dead is a really fuzzy area. Even mortal medicine regards death as a kind of process more than a state of being, a reversible process in some circumstances.
What are you getting at? I asked.
There's a difference between dead and... and gone.
I swallowed. So what do I do? Bob lunged to his feet.
What do you do?
He pointed at the table of Mother Butters's feast food.
You've got that to maybe get back to, and you're asking me what to do? You find your freaking killer. We'll both do it. I'll totally help.
The light in the room suddenly turned red. A red alert sound I remembered from old episodes of Star Trek buzzed through the air. I said, what the hell is that?
Butters calling me, Bob said, leaping to his feet.
The form of the young man, who I now realized must have looked a lot like Butters when he was a kid, only taller, started coming apart into the sparks of a wood fire.
Come on, Bob said. Let's go.
Chapter 36.
I didn't actually will myself out of the skull the way I'd gone in. Bob's passage just sort of swept me along in his wake, like a leaf being tugged after a passing tractor trailer. It was a forcible reminder that, the way things stood now, Bob was the heavyweight. I was just the skinny newbie. I hated that feeling. That feeling sucked. I reintegrated standing in a dusty room. Afternoon sunlight slanted through it, its danger abated by the thick coating of grime over the windows. The place looked like an industrial building's entryway. There was what had been a heavy-duty desk, maybe for a receptionist or security guard. The alcove housed rows of small personal lockers. Several rectangles of less faded commercial-grade taupe paint on the walls had probably been where a time clock and time card holders had gone. Butters stood nearby holding Bob's flashlight, and the eyes of the skull were glowing brightly with Bob's presence in the physical world, now that he had left his apartment. The little M.E. looked tense, focused, but not afraid. It wasn't much of a mystery how they'd gotten into the room. Fitz stood there with a set of bolt cutters with 3-foot-long handles held over his shoulder. Fitz looked scared enough for everyone there. The kid was back in the lair of his erstwhile mentor and terrified of his wrath. Yeah, I knew that feeling. Butters fumbled his little spirit radio out of his pocket and asked in a hushed voice,
Dresden, you there?
To your left, I said quietly. He shone Bob's eyelights my way and evidently saw me illuminated by them.
Oh, he said, looking relieved. Right. Good.
I had no clue why he looked relieved. It wasn't like I could do anything, unless some random ghost came by, in which case my memory-based magic could cook another being incapable of affecting the material world. But I guess he looked up to me, or at least to my memory, and I owed it to him to help however I could. So I gave him a calm nod and encouraging clench of my fist. Solid.
I take it we've come in through a blind spot? I asked Fitz quietly.
Fitz nodded.
The chains on the doors were enough, and he couldn't extend his guard spells any farther than the main room.
I grunted. That's good.
Why?
Butters asked. Means Aristides doesn't have enough power to just burn you to cinders on the spot. Butters swallowed.
Oh. Good.
Doesn't mean he can't kill you, I said. Just that he won't have a high FX budget when he does.
He's fast, Fitz said. His voice shook. He's really, really fast.
Like how fast? Butters asked.
Fast like Jackie Chan or fast like the Flash?
Little of both, I said. He can cover ground fast, and he can hit like a truck. Fitz nodded tightly.
Oh, Butters said. Super. We probably shouldn't fight him, then.
He set the flashlight aside and rummaged in the duffel bag.
Give me just a second.
A shadow flickered by one of the grime-filmed windows. Fitz let out a hiss and clutched the bolt cutters with both hands, ready to use them like a club. Butters let out an odd little chirping sound and pulled a big old cop-issue flashlight-slash-club from his bag. The shadow passed over another window. Someone outside was moving toward the door, coming in behind us. I took a quick look at the flashlight and made sure I was standing in the light of Bob's eyes and out of the path of any direct sunlight that might come through the door. I couldn't do anything, but if I was visibly standing there when the door opened, maybe I could distract Aristides, if it was him coming through. Maybe he'd speed rush right through me and into a wall and knock himself out like a cartoon villain. That would make me look cool upon cool. More likely, I wouldn't accomplish anything. But when your friends are in danger, you try anyway. The door opened, and I raised my arms into a dramatic stage magician's pose. It felt ridiculous, but body postures draw reactions from human beings on an almost atavistic level. We aren't that terribly far removed from our primal roots, where body language was more important than anything we said. My stance declared me the ruler of the local space, a man who was in control of everything happening around him, one who others would follow, a mix of maestro and madman that would identify me to instinct as the most dangerous thing in the room. Butters and Fitz hit the wall on either side of the door and raised their improvised weapons as it swung open. The door squealed dramatically on its hinges, and a large, menacing figure entered the building. It hesitated, lifting a hand to shield its eyes, apparently staring at me. Butters let out a shout and swung his flashlight at the figure. Fitz, by contrast, swept the heavy set of bolt cutters down in silence. Even in that flash of time, I had to admire Butters. The little guy couldn't fight, and he knew it, but he was smart enough to shout and draw the attention of the intruder toward the smaller, weaker, and lighter-armed of the two of them. He had intentionally thrown himself at a larger opponent to force the man to turn so that Fitz could swing at his back. No fighter, maybe, but the little guy had guts enough for any three bruisers. It didn't do either of them any good. The large man seemed to sense the ploy. He ducked the swinging bolt cutters without so much as turning around, and simultaneously snapped out his left arm, the heel of his hand thrusting forward. He hit Butters squarely in the belly and sent the little man sprawling. Then he whirled as Fitz recovered his balance and swung the bolt cutters again. He caught them with one hand, matching Fitz's strength with a single arm. Then, with a sinuous motion of his upper body that reminded me of Murphy at work, he both took the bolt cutters from Fitz's hands and sent the young man sprawling into Butters, who had just begun to climb to his feet again. They both went down in a heap as the door clanged shut. Daniel Carpenter, Michael Carpenter's eldest son, stood in place for a moment, holding the bolt cutters lightly, as tall and strong as his father, his gray eyes distant and cold. Then he glanced at me, opened his mouth, and closed it again. I waved at him and said, "Hi, Daniel." The sound of my voice came to him only through the radio in Butters's pocket. He blinked. "What the hell?" Daniel asked, staring at me. Then he looked at Butters, then at Fitz, and then at the bolt cutters. "I mean, seriously, what the hell, Butters? What the hell are you doing?" Butters pushed Fitz off him and eyed Daniel with annoyance.
"Quietly, please," he said in a lower, intent voice. "We're sneaking up on a bad guy here, and you aren't helping."
"Is that what you're doing?" Daniel asked, but at least he lowered his voice. "Because Ms. Murphy thinks you're losing your mind." Butters blinked.
"What? Why would Karen think that?"
"Because of that thing," Daniel said, nodding toward me.
"Ouch,"
I said. "That stings, Daniel."
"Dude," Butters said, "don't be a dick. That's Dresden. Or at least it's his spirit, which is mostly the same thing."
"We don't know that," Daniel shot back. "Things from the spirit world can look like whatever they want to look like. You know that." Didn't we already go through this proper identification thing? I complained.
I know, right?
Butters said to me.
See what she's got to be like?
Who? Daniel demanded.
Karen, obviously, Butters shot back. Since you vanished, Harry, she's been fighting a war and using whatever weapon she can find. Hell, she's even taken help from Marcone.
Daniel's face flushed darker. Do not talk about Ms. Murphy that way. She's the only reason the Fomor haven't terrorized Chicago like they have everywhere else.
The two don't preclude one another, Butters said with a sigh.
He looked at me and spread his hands.
You see what I'm dealing with.
I grimaced and nodded. It's about her job, I think. She's insecure about her place in the world. She was like this when I first opened up shop, about the time she got put in charge of S.I. Suspicious, close-minded, negative outlook about everything. It was impossible to talk to her. You're sneaking around against her orders, Daniel said to Butters. Butters got to his feet and offered Fitz a hand up.
Orders? This isn't the army, man, and Murphy isn't the king of Chicago. She can't order me to do anything.
I notice you say that when she's not in the room, I said.
I'm an independent thinker, not a martyr, Butters replied.
He squinted at Daniel.
Wait a minute. She had you tailing me?
Damn, I said. That is paranoid. Daniel shook his head, scowling briefly at me. You're going to have to come with me, Mr. Butters.
No, Butters said. I'm not.
Daniel set his jaw. Ms. Murphy said that for your own good, I was to get you out of whatever that creature got you into. So let's go.
No,
Butters said, glaring up at the much larger young man.
I'm not leaving Fort Hill to the mercy of a punk sorcerer.
Daniel blinked his eyes several times, and the determined belligerence went out of his stance. The father? He's here? He's in danger?
It gets less likely we're going to be able to help him the longer we stand around gabbing, Butters said.
He recovered his bag, rummaged in it, and added,
This will work better with you here anyway.
He straightened up and tossed a folded square of gray cloth at Daniel.
Put that on. Stay next to me. Don't talk.
Daniel stared at the cloth dubiously, then looked at Butters.
For Fort Hill,
Butters said quietly, softening his voice.
We'll leave as soon as he's safe, and you can take me straight to Karen. You have my word, okay?
Daniel agonized over it for a couple of seconds. Then he nodded at Butters and unfolded the gray cloth. Oh, I said, suddenly understanding the little guy's plan. Good call. The fabric isn't exactly right, but it's close. This could work. Butters nodded.
I thought it might. How should we approach it?
Small-timer like Aristides is insecure about the size of his magical penis, I said. Give his ego a few crumbs and he'll eat out of your hand.
We'll have to go to radio silence, Butters said. There wasn't time to make the headphones work with it.
If I think of anything imperative, I can tell Fitz. He'll pass it on. Fitz looked nervously between Butters, Daniel, and me.
Oh, sure, because I can hear Dresden even without a radio.
Butters drew a second square of gray cloth from the bag and then tossed the bag over to one side. Calmly, he unfolded the cloth and threw the hooded cloak it proved to be over his shoulders, fastening a clasp at his throat.
So, Harry, Butters said, how did the wardens like to make an entrance?
Chapter 37 Daniel Carpenter leaned back, lifted a size 14 work boot, and kicked the door leading to the factory floor completely off its hinges.
I was impressed. The kid had power. I mean, sure, the door was old and all, the hinges rusted, but it was still a freaking steel door, and it went a couple of feet through the air before it slammed down onto the floor with an enormous hollow boom that echoed through the huge room beyond it.
Thank you,
Butters said in an absolutely obnoxious British accent he normally reserved for the noblemen his players were supposed to hate at our old weekly gaming sessions. He sniffed and strode onto the factory floor, his footsteps clear and precise in the empty space. The fake warden's cloak floated in his wake. Daniel stomped along a step behind Butters, his dark brows lowered into a thug's glower. It looked pretty natural on him. He had one huge hand clamped down on the back of Fitz's neck,
and was dragging the kid along with brusque, casual power. Fitz looked intensely uncomfortable. Butters stopped at a faint old line of chalk on the floor, regarded it for a moment, and then called out,
"Hello? I say that. Is anyone at home? I'm here to speak to the sorcerer Herestetes. I was told he was to be found here."
He paused for maybe a second and a half and added,
"I've a warlock to catch in Trinidad in an hour. I would prefer not to draw this out."
No one answered. There were soft, furtive sounds, an old tennis shoe dragging across the concrete floor with a faint squeak. Footsteps. A soft exhalation. A faint grunt of exertion.
"Warden?"
Butters said. He picked at his teeth with his thumbnail. Daniel's shoulders locked up and tightened, and Fitz let out a short yowl.
"It's me," he called out frantically. "It's Fitz. Sir, they say they're here to talk to you about the Foam War."
"Fitz?"
said a voice from off to one side. One of the kids from the drive-by, the little one, emerged from behind a set of metal cabinets. He got a look at Fitz's situation and tensed into a crouch, ready to run.
"Hey, Zero,"
Fitz said, trying to sound casual as he all but dangled from Daniel's grip.
"The boss home?"
There was a swishing sound, as if someone had thrown a large ball at considerable speed. And then Aristides said from directly behind us,
"I am."
Daniel twitched, but Butters concealed his reaction masterfully. He simply glanced over his shoulder and regarded Aristides, who now stood in the newly doorless entryway. Butters arched an eyebrow as if he'd seen the trick before, but at least found it well done, and turned to face Aristides. He gave the man a slight bow and said,
"I am Warden Valdo. This is Warden Smythe."
Daniel glowered.
"If you aren't otherwise occupied, I wonder if we might ask for a moment of your time."
Aristides studied the three of them for a silent moment, his eyes narrowed. He was wearing a ragged old dark blue bathrobe over loose cotton chinos and a tank top. The hair on his chest was thick and dark. The tattoos around his skull and over his cheekbones stood out sharply against his pale skin.
"You are from the White Council?" he asked.
Butters studied him for a moment and then sighed.
"Should I start at the beginning again? Our files describe you as a minor but competent operator. Were they mistaken?"
Aristides folded his arms, his expression a neutral mask.
"I am, of course, aware of the White Council. What business do you have with me? And why are you holding my apprentice prisoner?"
I did a quick circle around Aristides. Since I was all ghosty, he never knew I was there. He didn't so much as get goosebumps on the back of his neck. I guessed that he was the opposite of Fort Hill. Being a self-centered megalomaniac hadn't prepared Aristides to be sensitive to anyone's soul at all. "There's a bulge under the robe at the small of his back," I said to Fitz. "Blink twice for yes, if you know what it is. Blink once for no." Fitz shot a glance at me and blinked twice. "A weapon?" I asked. "Two blinks. Gun? One blink. Knife? Two blinks." "Okay," I said. "That's definitely a need-to-know fact. If you get a chance, or if things get violent, tell Daniel about it." Two more nervous blinks. I hesitated and then said in a gentler voice, "Hang tough, kid. I've been where you are. It's going to be okay." No blinks. Fitz bit his lip. Butters, meanwhile, kept the dialogue going.
"Clearly, the Council finds the recent activities of the Fomor somewhat repulsive. Just as clearly, our recently concluded war with the Red Court has left us less able to act than we would have been otherwise."
Which, thinking about it, probably wasn't true. The Council finished the war with the Red Court with more active, experienced, dangerous wardens than they'd had when it started. Granted, the vast majority of them were a bunch of kids, Molly's age or younger, but they were already veterans.
but I was betting that the Fomor picking on a bunch of low-level talents was a problem that was fairly far down their priority list.
I'd heard the wardens were adept at coming to the point, Aristides said. Should we start again at the beginning to give you another chance to get there?
Butters gave the sorcerer a frosty smile and a small inclination of his head.
You and your crew are still here. That suggests competence. We approve of competence.
Aristides tilted his head to one side and was silent for a moment.
You've come to discuss a relationship of some kind.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves, Butters replied. I'm not a recruiter. This is a visit, a ground-level evaluation, if you will.
I hated to leave the three of them standing in front of Aristides and his knife, with nothing but Butters's gaming accent and a few yards of gray cloth to protect them, but we hadn't come here to face down Aristides. We were here for Fort Hill. The hasty plan I'd sketched with Butters called for me to locate the father while they kept Aristides' attention. Besides, those cloaks represented something that Aristides would respect if he had two brain cells to rub together. The wardens of the White Council had never been regarded as friendly figures like your local traffic cop. People feared them, probably all the more so since the war with the Red Court. The wardens were the guys who gave you one warning, way before you were anywhere close to crossing the line by breaking one of the laws of magic. The next time you saw them, they were probably there to cut off your head. Whether they were more respected or more feared depended greatly on one's point of view, but no one ever, ever took them lightly. It felt right somehow that Butters was trading on their fearsome reputation. Maybe it felt right because that reputation was, like me, immaterial, but not unable to alter events. The ghost of the warden's ferocity could do as much as I could to keep an eye on my companions. So I wished them luck within the silence of my thoughts and set out to accomplish my part of the plan. I vanished and reappeared at ceiling level, being careful to stay out of any direct sunlight as it streamed through a few small windows high up on the walls. The ceiling wasn't all that high compared to the area of the factory floor, and it took me several tries before I recognized the location of the gang's camp in all that abandoned space. I willed myself over to it and found Fort Hill. The priest was lying very still on the floor, curled into a half circle. I couldn't see if he was breathing, and I couldn't touch him to check for a pulse. I grimaced and knelt to thrust my hand into the matter of one of his feet. I felt the sharp, odd sensation of contact with living flesh, like when I'd touched both Morty and my apprentice, and not the sharp tingling of contact with something solid but inert. He was alive. It felt like my own heart had stopped beating and then lurched into gear again. I studied him for a moment, trying to assess what had happened to him. There was blood coming from several cuts around his face, where his thin, elderly skin had broken open under a sharp blow, across his cheekbones, his brow ridges, and on his chin. His lip had been split and was swelling. He'd taken a beating from someone's fists, or possibly from open-handed slaps delivered with supernatural speed. That felt right. The old priest, a living, breathing symbol of everything Aristides resented, must have shown up to talk. No matter how polite the father had been, his simple presence would have been challenge enough to the ego of anyone like the sorcerer. Challenges could be answered only with violence, and the slaps he delivered would have been both painful and insulting. Fort Hill's left arm was pressed against his ribs. He'd fallen and curled up around his midsection. The sorcerer must have given him some body blows as well, broken ribs maybe, or worse. Everything about trauma was worse when it happened to the elderly. Thinner skin, less muscle, less bone, worn organs. They were vulnerable. I ground my teeth and looked around the camp. Aristides had left the guard to watch Fort Hill. He was a boy, and he might have been a very scrawny and underfed 10-year-old at most. He sat near the fire barrel, shivering, holding a rusted old steak knife. His eyes roamed everywhere, but he wouldn't look at the priest's still form. Forthill suddenly shuddered and let out a soft moan before sinking into stillness again. The little boy with the knife looked away, his eyes suddenly wet. He wrapped his arms around his knees and rocked back and forth. I wasn't sure which sight hurt more. I clenched my jaw. What animal would do this to an old man? To a child? I felt my skin beginning to heat up, a reflection of the rage that had swelled up inside me again.
"It is better not to let such thoughts occupy your mind," said a very calm, very soothing voice.
I spun to face the speaker, the words of a spell on my tongue, ghostly power kindling in the palm of my right hand. A young woman stood over Forthill, opposite me, in a shaft of sunlight that spilled in through a hole in a blacked-out window. She was dressed in a black suit, a black shirt, a black tie. Her skin was dark, not like someone of African ancestry, but like someone had dunked her in a vat of perfectly black ink. The sclera, the whites of her eyes, were black too. In fact, the only things on her that weren't ink black were her eyes and the short sword she held in her hand, the blade dangling parallel to her leg. They were both shining silver with flecks of metallic gold. She met my gaze calmly and then glanced down at my right hand, where flickers of fire sent out wisps of smoke.
"Peace, Harry Dresden," she said. "I have not come to harm anyone."
I stared at her for a second and then checked the guard. The little kid hadn't reacted to the stranger's voice or presence, ergo she was a spirit like me. There were plenty of spirit beings who might show up when someone was dying, but not many of them could have been standing around in a ray of sunlight. And I'd seen a sword identical to the one she currently held back at the police station in Chicago Between.
"You're an angel," I said quietly. "An angel of death."
She nodded her head.
"Yes."
I rose slowly. I was a lot taller than the angel. I scowled at her. "Back off." She arched an eyebrow at me. Then she said,
"Are you threatening me?"
"Maybe I'm just curious about who will show up for you when it's your turn." She smiled. It moved only her lips.
"What exactly do you think you will accomplish here?"
"I'm looking out for my friend," I said. "He's going to be all right. Your services are not required."
"That is not yet clear," the angel said.
"Allow me to clarify," I said. "Touch him, and you and I are going to throw down." She pursed her lips briefly and then shook her head.
"One of us will."
"He's a good man," I said. "I won't let you hurt him."
The angel's eyebrows went up again. "Is that why you think I'm here?"
"Hello," I said. "Angel of Death, Grim Reaper. Ring any bells?"
The angel shook her head again, smiling a little more naturally. "You misunderstand my purpose."
"Educate me," I said.
"It is not within my purview to choose when a life will end. I am only an escort, a guardian, sent to convey a new freed soul to safety."
I scowled. "You think Forthill is so lost that he needs a guide?" She blinked at me once.
"No. He needs..."
She seemed to search for the proper word.
"His soul needs a bodyguard. To that purpose, I am here."
"A bodyguard?" I blurted. "What the hell has the father done that he needs a bodyguard in the afterlife?" She blinked at me again, gentle surprise on her face. It made her look very young, younger than Molly.
He spent a lifetime fighting darkness," she said, speaking gently and a bit slowly, as if she were stating something perfectly obvious to a small child. "There are forces that would want to take vengeance upon him while his soul is vulnerable during the transition."
I stared hard at the angel for several seconds, but I didn't detect anything like a lie in her. I looked down at the fire in my hand and suddenly felt a little bit silly.
"And you're going to be the one to fight for him?"
She stared at me with those silver eyes, and I felt my legs turn a little rubbery. It wasn't fear, exactly. It was something deeper, something more awe-inspiring. The feeling I had when I'd once seen a tornado from less than a quarter of a mile away, seen it tearing up trees by their roots and throwing them around like matchsticks.